a sheet of paper wilts in your hand. By noon, you can wipe your face with it like a handkerchief. You wake up glued to the sheets, the window fan puffing like someone out of breath, blowing rags of wet exhalation over you. You think that's the sound of the subconscious mind after a few years, a window fan laboring unnoticed near you, and you get where you can't sleep without it. A lot of older Mississippians, they have air conditioning now, but somebody should market a tape of a window fan running so they could get a little sleep. So that's a description of Southern humidity from Jack Butler's novel Jiu-Jitsu for Christ. I first heard about this book 8 years ago, back when being a book blogger was something akin to being an endangered sea turtle, which is to say there were only about 15 or 20 of us. Anyway, I got the book, read it, loved its brave juxtaposition of humor, young lust, and exploration of racism, and then I read all of Jack Butler's other volumes, including the big, excellent, and unsung novel Living in Little Rock with Miss Little Rock, which was actually a finalist for the Pulitzers, but is very difficult to find today. And then Jack Butler disappeared. He was one of those great, lost, underrated writers who had never quite had his due, and I was just curious about this. Well, enter Professor Brandon Costello. He's a guy who managed to get the rights back for Jiu-Jitsu for Christ, and he has just recently republished it with the University Press of Mississippi. So the book is now out. I urge you to read it. It's wonderful. It's one of those books where you scratch your head and say to yourself, why aren't other people talking about it? And as you will soon discover, well, this book, it almost came about by total accident in a publishing environment that was more open and far different than our present one, where you have to have a full novel, but we'll get into that. I had learned from Brandon that Jack Butler was not only alive and well, but he was willing to talk with me. So Jack Butler, he's only done about maybe 3 or 4 interviews in his life. I had to take Batsugendo out of retirement and talk with the guy. So we chatted for 1 hour. Here's the conversation. Enjoy. Hey, Jack, this is Ed. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Pretty well. It's a pleasure to meet you by Skype.
Yeah, it's first time I've ever done Skype, actually, so I guess it's historical.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen you do much in the way of interviews. You have the interview, I know, with Brandon, but have you done...
I've done 3 or 4, but I don't... You're right, I don't do very many of them.
Okay. Well, I will hopefully make this worth your while.
I'm sure it will be. Already has been.
Actually, where are you right now, out of curiosity? You're in Eureka?
Eureka, California. It's about as far north as you can go in California, and we're on the seacoast. We're right on the Pacific.
Oh, yeah. I used to be in San Francisco, so I know it very well.
Yeah. About 250 miles north of there.
You keep moving west, it seems. I almost expect you to be in the Pacific Ocean in about 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Or in an islands or something, right. Hawaii.
Well, it's I'm happier here than I was in the South, put it that way.
Well, I wanted to first of all talk about how you got your start. You were a poet before you were a fiction writer, and I also know that you were you have a bachelor's in English and a bachelor's in math. And I was wondering, how does a guy like you sort of have the yin yang thing going on here? It seems that you have a yin yang thing going on in terms of what you studied and what you ended up doing as a writer.
Yeah, a lot of that, at least as far as math and the arts go, is I loved science fiction as a kid. I used to read it all the time. Most of it's literarily horrible, but I was in Baptist Conservative Mississippi, and they weren't really aware of science fiction, so that was something I could get away with. And what I really loved was just the ability to speculate, you know, that the world might be different from what was right around you. For pretty obvious reasons. But I've always been interested in mathematics. I think one of the sad things about our culture is that we have such a dichotomy set up between art and science or math. I mean, the two things I say that people are most afraid of are poetry and mathematics.
Yeah. How has math and poetry encouraged you to speculate, both in terms of your imagination and in terms of, for example, books like Nightshade?
I guess it's just that they give me the tools. I'm pretty picky about details, even though I do get some things wrong. Just in case there's anybody listening, I'm not a medical person at all, and I gave the exact opposite cure for angina. I said digitalis, and that will kill you if you have angina. But aside from that, I'm, you know, like I had to get not only get the gravity of Mars right, I had to allow for it in every action, you know, which you just don't really see very much. So it's more nearly that it's given me the tools to do what I'm psychologically inclined to do.
So with science fiction, do you feel that it's that speculative nature that really makes it fiction or meaningful? That is really what has been, that was the drive for you when you were growing up, reading a lot of it as a boy, as a young man, and that kind of thing?
Yeah, right. And as I said in the interview with Brandon, I believe, the Delta had a big wide sky, you know, because of all the flat land and not too many trees. So in spite of the humidity, you could really see the stars. So that was, you know, I love the stars, and that got me going on that.
So your first three novels, Jiu-Jitsu for Christ, Nightshade, and Living Little Rock with Miss Little Rock, they all feature some intriguing narrative mode somewhere between, yeah, direct first person and a quite literally godlike omniscient voice. I mean, yeah. It almost reminds me to some degree of L'Outremont's narrator in the way that you sort of suggest to the reader that the narrator has lived, and this allows the narrator to share some experience with the reader. And I'm wondering, you know, why did you need this particular type of halfway narrator to tell a story for these first three books?
Well, I'll go back to, it's not really an anecdote, but when I first thought of having the Holy Ghost, and I hasten to add here, by the way, that I mean this is a model of the Holy Ghost. I'm not pretending to represent the actual thing, if it even exists. But, you know, it's like Wallace Stevens said, not as a God, but as a God might be. Well, not as the Holy Ghost, but as the Holy Ghost might be. And I couldn't believe nobody else had ever picked up on it. You had the ability to have both first-person narration and a switch, justified reason to switch personas. Yeah. It was wonderful. You know, it was wonderful. And, of course, I got all that Holy Ghost stuff, a lot of it. Growing up, you know, it was drilled into me. So it was a chance to play with that a little bit. One thing I've said about the Holy Ghost as narrator in Living in Little Rock with Miss Little Rock is that one of the main problems with Westernized Christianity is that we don't have a trickster God. And of the candidates, I thought the Holy Ghost was the best candidate for that. So the Holy Ghost is kind of a trickster there. As for the other, one of the things I'm really concerned about, not concerned about, one of the things I really like to think about is the nature of individuals, the nature of the individual mind. And so playing with narrators lets me play with that.
I'm wondering, did this reflect any kind of storytelling you heard growing up, that when people told you stories either around the house or around the town, that basically people kind of were telling you the absolute truth versus, or perhaps they were inserting their own asides, and this kind of reflected, was it something like that?
Well, it's true that people love anecdotes in the South. I think I've really got more of my tendencies from the fact that my father stood up in the pulpit every day and talked.
Yeah.
I mean, every day, but every week, and talked. So that's always seemed to me to be a natural thing to do. Like you point out, there were a lot of things that didn't scan for me with the stories I was told. And the Bible is, it's stories. You know, I love the Bible, but I view it as a library, not as a book. You know, it was written over several hundred years, maybe even 1,000 or more, by different people with different conceptions of God. And it's fascinating, but it's more fascinating as a narrative than anything else. So my storytelling probably had more to do with that. But there's the background. There's the background nature that Southerners in general love language, and they love to tell stories, and there's a premium put on wit. So I think that probably was just so natural, I assumed it without thinking of it.
So if the Bible is a library, what is the Ulysses or the Wasteland of the Bible?
I think it's both. Well, it's more beautiful than a wasteland. Ecclesiastes is one of the more beautiful things ever written, in my opinion. And it's very much not quite nihilistic, But Ecclesiastes very plainly does not countenance belief in an afterlife. It says people are just like grass, like the grass of the fields. We come from the same kind of place, and we go to the same kind of place when we die. Nobody imagines a heaven for grass. So if we're the same as grass, that has a lot of theological implications. That's dead in the middle of it. I was going to say, in answer to your question, that the Bible is almost its own wasteland. It's both a library and serves the function of Ulysses or the wasteland.
And can suck you in. It probably is a Finnegan's Wake, I guess.
Yeah, that too. They spoke in tongues quite a lot.
So you remark in this new forward for this new edition of Jiu-Jitsu that you had 60 pages in the synopsis before you actually had a publishing deal in place for this book.
Right. As anybody will tell you, to get an agent or to get something published, you have to have a full book. And I had gone to Norton with it, and they said, well, that sounds great. Send us the whole book. Well, I was looking for a motivation to write the rest of it. And I'd been sitting on it for almost 15 years. And finally, the very good local publisher, now no longer in business, called August House, offered me $2,000, half up front and half on completion. And that seemed like all the money in the world to me for a piece of writing at the time. It was 1985, and it just seemed like a lot. It was enough to motivate me, so I went on and finished it. And weirdly enough, my history has been I have never sold a book on anything more than a synopsis and I don't know, 60 to 100 pages.
Oh,
for
wow.
Some reason, it's always worked out that way.
You couldn't do that today.
No, you couldn't. What happened was I sort of stumbled accidentally into becoming a novelist. As you say, I was focused more on poetry. At least that's the emphasis I took in grad school, was poetry over narration. But I had always thought of storytelling and poetry as just being any writer should be able to do both of them. But as it developed, you could get money for novels and you couldn't for poems. And that had some effect.
So you say that you were sitting on this 60-page prototype of Jiu-Jitsu for 15 years. Is that true?
Yeah, and I don't think it was nearly as clear-cut then. It had gotten started by a notice on the bulletin board that the Judo for Christ Club would meet on a given day. And I started wondering exactly what sort of person would think up something like that. And that led to the character Roger Wing, and that eventually led to the rest of it. But I, at the time, I didn't quite know where I was going with it. And I didn't. It was also, I have to say, at that time, extremely painful to me to grind out pages. I was accustomed to having to spend months and months finishing up a short story of 20 pages. I had no idea how I'd finish a novel.
So you had no idea at the time how you were going to tie up Jiu-Jitsu at the end with that very apocalyptic moment in the Colosseum taken from real life.
No, I hadn't even thought about it. The plot just led to it pretty naturally for me. The way I see it, one reason for writing is to discover things, to find out things. I don't quite understand how I could stay motivated if I already knew everything that was going to happen. So I write in order to find out where the story's going, as much as anything.
Well, this leads me to wonder, I mean, I want to bring up the critic Tom LeClair. He coined this term prodigious fiction to account for these very smart information pack rat novelists like Richard Powers, David Foster Wallace, mm-hmm. and William T. Volman. I think I could put you in the same category because your fiction has often included math, it has illustrations, clippings. One of the best descriptions I think I've ever read of humidity in jiu-jitsu.
yeah.
You know, I've actually forwarded that on to a number of people from the South, and they say, wow, how did he capture that so well? But
well,
I have to ask...
Years of living with it.
Yeah, well, I have to ask, you know, to what degree is a novel comparable with, say, a 7-layer burrito? What do you think accounts for some of the asides that you often put in your work, especially something massive like Living in Little Rock with Miss Little Rock?
I've always said that I consider myself more nearly an entertainer than a guru, way more nearly. because an entertainer has to respect the audience, and you have to be aware of what fascinates people. Well, I love mathematics. I love all these mental games myself, but that's not enough. They have to be interesting to other people. So I feel that you've got to really get a lot of dynamics going. You really got to get the story rolling before you can. You don't just start. You don't just throw information at a reader. It has to come out of the story. So I love it, but I have to situate it in a way so that the reader might like it too. I can't really afford to take time out and bore the reader while I indulge myself. I just don't see it that way.
So you were alluding earlier to being pushed west, and we were joking about finding yourself on an island. I want to talk about this because Los Angeles is this interesting source of escape in jiu-jitsu. Uh-huh. You've got Dreamer, which is set in Santa Fe. Uh-huh. You were the creative writing director at the College of Santa Fe.
No longer in existence.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, you know, you were telling me that it was painful for you to think about the South. What do you think forced your fiction out of the South? Was it in some way related to the sheer exhaustion of writing something as massive as living in Little Rock? Or
well, one of the that really was more. It was exhausting, but it was also very liberating. One of the more frustrating things about being in the South was that there was, both in religion and in politics, just a hard party line that even as a kid, though I didn't get out of all of that. I even became a Baptist preacher myself briefly as a young man, 22. It just didn't scan. You know, there's a lot of things that I was being told that just didn't make any sense. So I found it easier to get away from that. I also, there's a problem. If you get tagged as a Southern writer, there are certain immediate expectations, you know, there's certain attitudes, certain ways of looking at things. And I didn't want to be bound by those, but I don't have anything against my Southern background. I'm proud of it. So I can't leave the South in storytelling really because I was born there in the South. You know, there's no way to leave it, but there is the rest of the world. And I've done a lot of how Southerners would react when they're in worlds that are not the South. I've done some of that. And I just wanted, it wasn't that conscious, but I wanted to defeat the chaining assumptions of being tagged as a Southern writer. I don't mind being thought of one, I just didn't want to be limited by that.
Huh. Why do you think Southern writer is a limitation? For a lot of people, it's paid off tremendously.
It has, but that's exactly why it's a limitation. Huh. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's a limitation at any rate. You are expected it's almost like the way people think about Native Americans as if they weren't just as human as anybody else. You're expected to be more religious, more in tune with nature, blah, blah, blah. You see what I'm saying? And that just doesn't make sense to me.
You mean to say that you didn't want to be held accountable for the territory you grew up in and lived in? You didn't want to be the spokesman or the op-ed person that appeared on TV like a lot of Southern novelists? Or?
I don't want to be an apologist for bigotry. There's no doubt about that. I don't mind being considered from the South. I never try to hide the fact or anything else. Sometimes I even brag about it. But I just didn't want to be bound by a certain increasingly standard set of assumptions. And one of them, I don't mean to be saying anything touchy here, but one of them is the general assumption that as a Southern writer, you're probably not quite as intelligent as other Southern writers. You're more authentic, quotes around it, more genuine, quotes around that, but you're not quite allowed to play with the big boys. Well, it works fine financially when, as back in the 50s and up until the late 60s, I guess, there's a sort of a premium on Southern writers. They're lauded and hailed, probably mostly as a result of a few good writers like Eudora Welty and Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor and so on. But when it falls out of favor, all of a sudden, you know, all the negative things come up. Well, I wanted a stance that wasn't limited to whatever the literary fashion was at the moment. I'm not that interested in what's popular officially, if you know what I mean. I just want to write stories that people really like. That's what I wanted to do.
You suggested in the interview you did with Brandon that science fiction and Southern literature were these two lowbrow inspirational territories for you during the 1980s and the 1990s.
Right.
And now we have a really unusual situation where literary writers such as Ben Marcus and Colson right. Whitehead, they're unsuccessfully, in my view, scavenging from genre to try to matter to an audience.
Yeah.
At the same time, you also have writers like Chabon and David Mitchell, and they use it to propel themselves into some meaningful stylistic advancement or achievement or some meaningful view of humanity. How yeah. has this worked for you, and how have you managed to avoid this sort of parasitic relationship to genre?
I'm really interested in stories. I'm really interested in human behavior. And to me, that's the fundamental realism. I don't care how metaphysical your illusions may be, but the basic thing that fascinates me is human behavior. And as I say, writing to me is an exploration of that. So I really enjoy the getting there. I'm just not really paying very much attention to those other things, I guess. You know, I'm not deliberately taking a stance against anything. I'm just not terribly interested in categories and that sort of thing. I mean, some of them are useful, but only in a limited way.
So you have in jiu-jitsu this interesting scenario where the African Americans that you depict waver between being stereotypical and also completely divergent of that stereotype. I'm going to try not to give it away, but I think of the stunning response to the Governor Barnett's I Love Our Customs at the Coliseum. Yeah. I'm wondering if the idea here is to show that all of us are susceptible to either reinforcing these stereotypes or being driven to do so by powerful figures. What is the motivation of oscillating between these two points?
Well, one of the motivations is that I do caricature better than I do straight stuff sometimes. So I naturally incline. And also, I really like is not a very good word, but humor is important to me. I can't think of anything I've written that isn't humorous on some level. So that sometimes leads you to the stereotypes. But the other thing is, in Mississippi, one of the things I was most deeply frustrated about, and one of the things I continue to hold, is the sense that all of us, well, the way I put it is people are people, and that's just it. You know, blacks, whites, there was no essential difference, but the whole state was busy pretending there was. I couldn't help but think of what a great culture we might have founded if the blacks and the whites had been able to talk to each other. You know, but because of the bigotry, we were polarized. And my sense of it is that, well, as a child, I grew up spending overnights in blacks' homes, well, shanties, really, is what they were, and things like that. And I'm deeply convinced that the Southern experience has been pretty similar for blacks and whites, except that the blacks were restricted legally. Well, it shouldn't have been legal, but you know what I mean. In Mississippi, it was just unfair. But the point was that they are so similar that if there are benefits, as some people argue, from having been brought up in the South, they accrue to most people. Years later, when I was at the College of Santa Fe, as you mentioned, there was a woman working in the humanities office there, and she was black, and yet we felt closer to each other and had more conversation than we did with anybody else.
Yeah.
Because we had such a commonality of experience, if you see what I mean. So that's one of the things I'm after.
How does knowledge tie into this notion of common experience? I mean, in jiu-jitsu, we see a scenario in which the family, the Gradys, they're scavenging from comic books, You have this situation where there are these disused books that are picked up and put in a library. They're from the street, and that's their information. That's their source of knowledge. That's their bedrock right there.
Well, the thing I was attempting to point out there was that Mr. Gandhi was way more literary than most of the white people who prided themselves on you know, being more sophisticated. He was really interested in books for the basic reason that there was stuff in books that mattered. And so his culture, the culture in Mississippi, didn't allow him typical literary standing, but his desire to read functioned so deeply in him, mattered so much to him, that he took books where he could find them. You know, that was my sense of it.
But it's interesting, too, that there's this scavenger notion of being a literary person or right. being a well-read person, not just in jiu-jitsu, but also I think of living in Little Rock, where we have a character named Jack Butler, who is a science fiction writer. And he speaks with...
More or less a caricature of the actual author, Jack Butler, who, by the way, I am insisting in later works is a character invented by Marcus Gandhi. Yeah. Up in jiu-jitsu. I said in the interview with Brannon that something that I really don't think a lot of literary people are able to get their head around, it isn't that I'm bravely incorporating pop culture into literary works. It's just that I use all sorts of genres because I've read all sorts of genres. And to me, literature is a genre. You don't get literature because people have been educated in literature and nothing else, and they're directed at literature. You get it because people care about writing something strong, whatever walk of life they're in.
Sure. But I think with Jack Butler in Living in Little Rock, the fictional Jack Butler, right. I mean, here's a guy who says, I don't write autobiographical fiction, and yet he's being asked to talk about his books to the Morrisons there. And
yeah,
so
that was a joke.
Yeah.
You know,
that
was making fun of myself there. Because I've often claimed that I do not write autobiographical fiction. And really, I don't, in the sense that there is no character that's a map of myself as I see myself. There's just not. But I was kind of playing with the boundaries there. I thought it would be funny to have a character that is about me and say that he doesn't write autobiographical stuff.
But he also doesn't want to commit himself to anything terribly personal. That's what makes it very funny, that whole chapter.
Right, right. That whole chapter, at the beginning of the chapter, I was more or less making fun of the neediness of writers, including myself. You know, I once had a cohort who just got really worked up and excited and just put so much energy into getting his reading correct. It was a reading to introduce freshmen to the writing program at the College of Santa Fe. And I thought, man, we're really needy if we have to get so worked up over getting freshmen to hear our stuff. Part of that's the function of the culture at large not really having much use for literature nowadays. But part of it's the willingness with which a lot of us have gone along with, you know, the stereotypes.
But with books in the state that they are today, how do we combat desperation? I mean, we're seeing a full-scale assault on anybody who doesn't sell. I mean, a lot of Midlesters, in fact, had to go to small presses. They've had to go to Amazon. And there's more neediness than ever.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the Midlisters, I hope.
Yeah.
That's at best. But, yeah, theoretically, publish on demand should have removed the middleman. It hasn't happened yet, and I think that's mostly because everybody's looking for a way to make a buck off of it. As for fighting desperation, I really don't think you can fight it. I think you mostly have to ignore it.
So I wanted to discuss Bum Festrick, who was this racist newspaper columnist in jiu-jitsu. My understanding is that you modeled him on the Clarion Ledger's Tom Etheridge. So,
Yes.
Well, how did you use Etheridge's columns as a guide for Festrick? I mean, you have pointed out that your fictional characters come from individuals who bear certain marks of somebody else. How did this work for Festrick?
Well, I oddly enough, I was hoping somebody could make the connection eventually, because I thought the columns were so disgusting that he deserved that kind of regard. But at the same time, I'm not so damn self-certain that I feel like I know everything that's going on in another person and I have a right to totally judge them. I was guided more by the rhetoric than anything else. I think I stayed true to the rhetoric of Etheridge's columns. I you can examine them for yourself, but I think they were as over the top and as shrill and as preposterously self-contradictory as I've portrayed Festrich's. And the Clarion Ledger was a real newspaper. I have to say, by the way, that the current editor has made a lot of changes, and I've got quite a few friends in Mississippi who are younger, and they just aren't part of that previous culture. They're working for something different.
I'm wondering if you had to go to vile racist language in a newspaper in order to tap into this really terrible truth that you were writing about in jiu-jitsu.
Right. One thing that is not an invention at all is the mimeographed handout by the Citizens Council that Eleanor Roosevelt has in her bottom dresser drawer. There actually was that document, and if I remember correctly, I quoted it word for word. So my concern there was the social inequities. What happens when you've got such rigid and rigidly wrong people using a system of laws and communications in a way that it shouldn't be used, using it for propaganda? I was very concerned with that, and I thought that exacerbated a whole lot of what was wrong in Mississippi. I thought that without the encouragement of stuff like that, maybe the whole crisis wouldn't have been quite so great. So I definitely wanted to explode what I call institutional bigotry as opposed to individual bigotry.
Gotcha. So I wanted to talk about the sex in jiu-jitsu. There's this early moment with Roger and Patsy. You have the later moment with Roger and Eleanor Roosevelt. And then you have that moment with the movie magazine, which is quite on the crazy side. It almost feels more blasphemous than anything religious within the book. And I was wondering if the idea was to give these characters a life outside of religion where they could commit happy blasphemies to endear themselves to the reader.
Yeah, that exactly. You've probably heard it, but there's a Southern Baptist joke that I just love. It runs, "Do you know why Southern Baptists don't like sex? It's too much like dancing." And it was something like that, yeah. I think sexuality, I was trying to look at the way sexuality actually works. I always have been interested in that, not in theological stereotypes of what sex might be. Hugh Hefner, with his confounded Playboy philosophy, which corrupted my head as a young man, is just as bad about sex, in my opinion, as the Baptists were. His effects were less harmful, perhaps, but he's just as mistaken. So I was more concerned with, in a comic way, exploring what sexuality to me seemed to actually be, as opposed to all of the things that we were told about it, you know, as I was growing up.
Well, how is Hefner more blasphemous in his own way, or wrong?
Well, he's invented a philosophy about which he wrote
the
endlessly.
Poems, yeah.
Endlessly. And he's invented a philosophy which justifies the behavior that he wants to engage in. Well, that's backwards. I think first you look at the way life goes, and then you try to see what you can figure out about what the actualities are. You don't first come with your idea and then try to force the facts to fit it. So I think both Hefner and his Playboy philosophy, and the Southern Baptists had mistaken views, basically because they were trying to justify what they already thought by means of what they think of as a theology or a philosophy. And again, I've got too much of the scientist in me. I think you look at how things actually work, and you talk about that, and then you come to conclusions. Novels are great for that, stories in general, because you actually show people. And the crux is, are these people believable? Are they credible? If they are, then the experience is credible. So you can, in a way, show the foundations for a different way of looking at things. You don't argue for it, but if your characters are convincing, if they're believable, if they're real, then you know they're part of the way actuality goes.
So it seems to me that if you are exploring religion in fiction, you almost have to explore the ideological construct in other arenas, whether it be sex, whether it be politics, in order to really wrap your head around the way people deceive themselves.
Yeah, and I don't leave myself out of that category of the self-deceivers by any means. I think it's a fundamental human property. But you can work against that, and you can put a lot of energy into being observant and accurate, or you can just throw all that in the trash can and declare the way things ought to be, supposedly from some prior sense of what's right. I just wasn't for that latter way at all. I just wasn't. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think there would be a lot less pain in the world if we could look at the way things actually go. For example, the whole gay rights stuff. Look at what actually happens. Quit making these stupid arguments that have nothing to do with anything. That's the way I felt about it. Look at what actually happens.
Yeah, it's interesting on that point how there's been all this ridiculous metaphor applied as opposed to really understanding the commonalities.
Right. I mean, basically people are people. People, again, you know, we're pretty much all the same psychologically. And we pretty much all have the tendency to want to find explanations. Well, there are explanations that for the people, their adherents, remove the necessity to do any further thinking or work. And there are things in the direction of an explanation which you have to do a lot of work and a lot of thinking to stay to further. And I like that approach much better.
I have to ask, what's going on back there? There's a lot of crashing.
that's our dog. We have a Belgian Malinois who is a puppy by age, but not by size. And Malinois, she's very calm right now. She's not barking. No, she's all right. She's as long as
if I hear her making a lot of noise.
Is it too obstreperous, causing too much trouble?
There's been a little bit of noise, but I could deal with it, I guess.
She's not barking, which to us is peace, and so I didn't even notice.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, there's just been a bunch of bumptious bumping and all that.
No, that's her in the background, and I think my daughter's going to take her out.
Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, speaking of bumping and collisions, I know that in a lot of early work from novelists, you see what I identify often as corporeal collision, meaning a lot of sex and violence, and I think that's the case with your work.
Basically, the reason that the sex is in my fiction is because I like it a lot. And I'm also aware that it appeals to people. Why shouldn't it appeal to people? The reason the violence is there is because, to me, violence is the biggest challenge to any kind of morality, social morality we may develop. And I just don't think you can ignore it. I think you have to deal with it.
You said that you approach the holy through the material, which is interesting given the Holy Ghost and living in Miss Little Rock. I was hoping you could expand on this. How does subverting religion, such as this early moment in jiu-jitsu where Roger and Patsy turn a sketch pad upside down to appeal to their audience, how does this allow you to unpack its truths?
Well, I'm not really trying to subvert religion. I'm just trying to expose human mannerisms in connection with it, or, and preferably humorously, so they'll be entertaining. And there were plenty of chalk talks. They called them. My mother used to give chalk talks, and something very like that chalk talk she did one time. So I wasn't really making up satirical stuff. I was just taking it literally. Stuff like that happens all the time. But I was aware of how comic it could be. And most, I suppose most chalk talk audiences aren't thinking about that. Again, I'm not so much wanting to subvert religion as, well, the Dalai Lama said something recently that I really like. He said, if science disproves something about Buddhism, then Buddhism must change. That's the kind of religion I admire. I think we have reason, and it just doesn't make sense to me that we shouldn't use reason. So we should use reason on everything, and including theologies. And what saves you from, in my opinion, from being dry, if you do that, is humor, a sense of humor, being able to make fun of yourself and of things around you.
Yeah. So Eleanor Roosevelt, I wanted to ask you about her because she seems to me a very Ophelia-like character, which is rather alarming for a novel that is essentially comic. I'm wondering if she existed in this sort of tragic mode so that you could calibrate the needle, so to speak, to take this book seriously.
Well, I wasn't thinking in those terms. I know what you mean. Eleanor Roosevelt is to some degree complicit in her own undoing. Roger, of course, is more so. And by the way, I hasten to add, this is a very good example of something that is not autobiographical. Never had any experience like that, thank God. I'm not above it, I suppose, but it's not me. But to me, the tragedy and the comedy exist together, simultaneously, and they exist in human nature and in human social arrangements. They're already there, so I don't have to strategize about them. Eleanor Roosevelt is both comic and tragic at the same time. That was one of the implications I intended in the title of the book, by the way, which got voted worst title of the year at
Really?
at the ABA in New Orleans that year. I hope it was humorous, but something can be terrifyingly repulsive and funny at the same time. To me, that's just the way life is. It's not always that way, of course, but it wasn't a stretch. Eleanor Roosevelt was really violated, but I wanted to show it in a realish world, not as some point of view or some advocate for, the supposedly perfect behavior. I just wanted to show humans.
Yes. So the Mississippi humidity moment, did that start off as a poem? I mean, that just seemed like something you were working on for years, thinking about. I mean, I know you were living it for years.
I'm glad it seems that way, but no, it didn't. I had no idea I was about to go off on it until I began writing it. The way I wrote the book after I got the contract with August House was I would go into work. This was when so-called personal computers were just coming in, and I had an IBM clone that must have weighed 40 pounds and was referred to as a personal computer.
Yeah, I remember those.
It had like 128 bytes, I think. But it was so wonderful. I no longer had to retype a whole chapter because I fixed a couple of sentences. You know what I mean? It was just for a writer, it was just a wonderful convenience. So I would go in before work hours, and I wrote the rest of the book on that 40-pound. It was called Columbia, IBM clone. We had to use command language. There were no interfaces at the time, but it was still so much command language interface, I think they call it CLI. But it was so much better than typing stuff. I just loved it. But no, I didn't think of that until I got to it, really. That's one of the things that I really like about fiction is that it throws up these opportunities to just go off and do some great stuff. And the fact that I am a poet played into it, but it's not if you knew how many poems I've written over the years, you wouldn't have the notion that I was saving them back.
So what accounts for the slowdown in speed? I mean, you wrote a good chunk of Jiu-Jitsu very fast. You wrote Nightshade in a great blur. It seems to me that the technology was part of that. A contract was part of that. What has caused you to slow down over the last years?
I don't know. Maybe it's age. I'm not sure. I wondered the same thing myself. Those were stories, especially Jiu-Jitsu for Christ, that I just had to tell. I just had to write. And it may be that I don't have the same compulsion anymore. Maybe I've said most of what I have to say. I don't know. I hope not. But, you're right. There is a slowdown that composition has become slower, especially. Well, I find myself doing a lot of essays nowadays. And that takes away from fiction and takes away from poetry. In other words, to me, an essay is an attempt to approach a subject directly, whereas with poetry and with fiction in different ways, you are not so much trying to deliver a meaning as playing with meaning itself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's more like
yeah.
play. It's less like grim and sober determination. And maybe I'm less playful. I hope not, but maybe so. I really don't know, I guess that's a short answer.
Does a writer need a sense of compulsion?
I did when I was younger. I don't know. Now, to some extent you do, in the sense that there's a barrier. Why raise your voice? Why say anything to anybody? You know, there's no such thing as perfect communication. And sometimes you just feel like, well, why bother? Why bother putting in my two bits? Well, compulsion to write a story would override that when I was younger. It doesn't override it as much now because I don't have as many. I still look at things in pretty much the same way, and I still write pretty much the same way with a lot more knowledge, I hope. But it's the question of why should I speak up? I thought it was pretty clear why I should speak up in Jiu-Jitsu for Christ, that I grew up witnessing a very great evil, and I just had to say something about it. None of my other books have a ready-made social topic, so to speak. So they're all more voluntary. They're all more just, I'm just telling the story because I like to tell this story. You know, with Jiu-Jitsu, I did feel compelled to, in some way, memorialize the South that I had grown up in.
Yeah. So what we may be talking about here is a situation where you grow older, become more confident, and become more certain of yourself. And maybe that's what has caused you to become less compulsive. Would you say that might be the case?
Well, I'm calmer. I don't know if I'm more certain of myself, but I'm less likely to fly off the handle. There's some juice you can get from being really wound up about something. And I believe in taking energy wherever it's offered to you. So I was happy to be compelled to write about race in Mississippi at a certain period. As I say, none of my other stories have compelled me quite that way. I remember thinking after I finished Jiu-Jitsu, well, that pretty much does it. I don't have any more causes to write about. So I wonder what I'm going to write now. And it's still that way. I haven't gone looking for other causes. I'm not a moralist of that stripe.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to convert people or tell people what to do or anything like that.
Maybe a cause may cause you to turn something around faster or really fill out the expanses of a particular work you're on.
Well, you feel like you've got something behind you. You feel more justified. You know, there are a lot of, I didn't know how to write a novel. I had this sneaking feeling the whole time that I was writing Jiu-Jitsu for Christ that maybe somebody after it came out would say, well, that's all very well, Mr. Butler, but it's not really a novel, you know, because I wasn't quite sure what a novel was. And nobody ever did that. So I decided a novel was what Jiu-Jitsu was, which is, you throw in almost everything that's going on with you right now. That's what living in Little Rock with Miss Little Rock was. I threw in everything that I knew how to do, everything that I knew about. Well, not everything, but, you know, everything that the opportunity offered for. So I was as passionate about living in Little Rock with Miss Little Rock and the other novels as with Jiu-Jitsu for Christ, but I no longer felt I had, this is a loaded phrase, but so to speak, the approval of that would be generated by, quote, doing the right thing. I didn't have that. And I'm sort of proud of the fact that not having it, I didn't go looking for it again. You know, I didn't take up some other cause. I spoke out of the one that I had personally experienced. I didn't try to take up other causes. Attitudes about what's right and wrong, but that's different from being a consistent advocate, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Well, one thing I wanted to actually ask you about is the fact that you value really lengthy conversations of people just hanging out in a way that you don't often see in fiction. And I like it because it really reflects the idea of living in the South. And yet you've moved away from that as the books have continued. And I'm wondering, you know, why that sort of stretched, expansive conversation was of appeal to you. Was it simply trying to chase that feeling, or was it really more about capturing, whether it be Mississippi or Arkansas, in that one great shot?
Yeah, I think it's a desire to allow the reader to experience things as I've seen them. Not exactly to capture them, but yeah, in a sense you have to capture them because you have to get them exactly right, or they're just not going to feel right to the reader. But I think a fiction is a model of experience, but it's a model that we can incorporate into our own lives almost as directly as experience per se, as real life, you know. And so people talk like that, or at least the people I grew up around did. And I think that as time has gone on, I may have become a little less adventurous. You know, the literary attitudes leak into your head anyway, no matter how you resist them. Part of me, I've been well aware of it, has started worrying about, is this okay or is this not? You know, back then I wasn't worrying about whether I should do it or not. I was just trying to find out if I could.
So what is the status of Elijah Lee Roswell?
Well, I have a complete manuscript, but I'm not entirely happy with it. Interestingly enough, I was thinking about that in connection with your last question about the conversations, because that's one of the things I'm not entirely happy with yet. They feel to me more forced and less naturally emerging from the character, and I want to fix that. Levy Press, out of Mississippi, incidentally, is, we have a contract for them to print roughly the first third of the book. After that, I'm going to market it. I know, because of some stupid decisions I made, I no longer have an agent. So I would be marketing the book probably myself. But it would be the first time I have a novel already ready that I'm trying to sell. So that's going to be kind of a luxury, really. But it's slow going revising. It's been slow going. But there's a completed manuscript. You could tell what the story is already, and some of the metaphysics of it, but it's just not the way I want it yet. One of the things I've always had that I'm really glad to have had is this sense that the perfect way of saying it is out there, and I just have to stick to it until it comes.
So there's two questions here. What happened with your agent, first and foremost?
Okay. My agent was Henry Dunow, who is now retired, but the Dunow Literary Agency still functions in New York, and I can't say enough good about him. I stupidly, at one point, having been persuaded by my wife at the time, that I could make more money as a novelist if I had an agent who would go after bigger books. Well, that turned out not to be true. I had a couple of interim agents, and I never gave them anything to sell. And then after that, I just drifted. I may go back to the Dunow agency and see if they're interested in Elijah Lee. I'd like to have somebody take all the publication decisions and that sort of thing away from me because I'm not terribly interested in them. So I don't know. It was a stupid thing. I was being allowing myself to be persuaded to go after Bucks, whereas actually Henry had done the only dollar good I had ever gotten out of writing. I mean, basic major good. So I owed him a lot, and I didn't seem to realize it at the time. I feel bad about that.
Huh. I mean, this is interesting because I don't think you've really gone after the Bucks in your fiction. So why the sort of late life desire?
Well, no, it wasn't late life. It's always been there. But my attitude has always been, there's nothing wrong with getting plenty of money for what you write. But it can be very dangerous to write with the idea of getting that money in your mind. That's like having a master standing over your shoulder telling you, oh, that might not work with a wider audience. And oh, that might. Well, that voice just has to be exercised. And so once I've written the stuff, I would like to get as much as I can out of it. But I just, it's just not as much fun to write if you're thinking about that ahead of time.
Do you think that this accounts for why Elijah Lee has become forced in your point of view?
I think that's less about money and more about sort of having, I'm being unfair to literature. Brannon, of course, has his PhD in English and teaches at LSU, and he's great, and a lot of them are. I'm a big fan of academics in spite of the fact I've never quite fit in there, because that's where the knowledge that nobody cares about financially gets preserved, you know, and I care a lot about that. I think it's the whisper of forbidden styles and things more than it is the whisper of money. I've allowed that to leak into my head, my awareness of how, let's say, some critic might take things. I'm rebellious against that thing, but it does leak into your head.
But rebellion, I think, is a very helpful drive to do something different in fiction, right?
Right, it is. It is. I mean, there are plenty of people that think about having a bestseller as having sold out. Well, not necessarily. Most of the people who sell out, you know, they just finally found a buyer. They'd been selling out a long time before.
And you've never quite sold out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've resisted in the sense that basically it's just getting all the other voices besides the voice of what you're writing on out of your head. You know, that goes all the way back to creative writing workshops. When I was young, I just found something deeply flawed in that process of mutual inhibition. You know, I don't want that. I don't like that. So I'm sure that I won't be satisfied with Elijah Lee, for example, until I no longer have any feeling that anything in it has been influenced by the idea of, oh, you should do things this way or that way. You know, I'm not trying to go against literary notions of excellence at all. I'm just wanting to get the voices out of my head, the conflicting voices that will sap your verve or whatever. You know, that's all.
Sap your verve seems like a good point to end this conversation. But hey, Jack, I really appreciate you taking the time out. It was great to finally talk with you. I've read your stuff for years and never thought it would come to this. So thanks so much for taking the time.
It was a great privilege for me. It's gonna be here soon. It's gonna cover me with leaves like a blanket from the moon.